This week's Torah portion is Chayei Sarah. Chayei Sarah is the story of what happens when Abraham and Isaac come down the mountain, and Sarah is dead, right? She either there's a whole bunch of stuff that happens and the Torah doesn't bother to recount it, or the first thing that happens when Abraham and Isaac come down is they find that Sarah has passed on in her old age. So they have to find a burial place for her. That's the one that rabbis love to talk about. The next thing that happens in the story is Abraham dispatches his chief servant Eliezer to go find a wife for Isaac. And it's a long story. And if we read it just straight up with our 21st century eyes, it's the story of, you know, an arranged marriage where a woman is basically treated as chattel property, right? It's to read it in a feminist viewpoint in the 21st century is to say this is kind of a sexist text. So trying to find a way to reclaim that means, well, one, we could skip it. Two, we could read it in its historical context, which is a thing that I do often with Torah, which is to say, let's read this text and acknowledge that it has its own version of feminist progressiveness if we understand that it could be worse, which isn't a great way to read it. Remember, though, that when we read a text in a Hasidic way, they're only interested in the ways in which the text can be personally meaningful. So we're not really interested in the feminist read of Rebecca. The other thing, though, I'll say to condemn our Hasidic rabbis is to point out that they overwhelmingly are interested in the man's perspective. They really care about Abraham and Eliezer in this story. There's another piece here that's a little tricky, which is to point out that the Hasidim are never going to be felicitous to the read of a character who is not Jewish, right? And that's based on, like, literally 2,000 years of, here's that word again, bias that the tradition gives us, right? The rabbis of the Talmud, the rabbis of the medieval period, the rabbis after that, are all going to generally see a character who is not Jewish in the Torah and make assumptions. And the assumptions are, well, the Jews are the good guys, and the non-Jewish characters are either neutral or bad guys. So I tried to read around those readings, but I think the best way to allow you to judge for yourself is to kind of look at this story. So we're going to read it. I'm going to read it from start to finish really quickly. If I'm reading really fast and you're like, can you slow down, Rabbi? One, you can pull this up on your own computer or pull out your own Tanakh if you want to focus in on something. And two, this is the longest chapter in the Bible. So chapters are fairly arbitrarily broken up into numerical chapters and their numeric verses, right? The Torah, the Masoretes in the 13th century were the ones who laid down the periods and the commas in Torah, but they never broke it up into chapters. So the fact that this is the longest chapter in the Torah is fairly arbitrary, but it is what it is. And Abraham was old, advanced in years. Actually, we don't need any of this early part. Just trust me. Abraham says to Eliezer, his chief servant, swear to me you'll go get me a good wife for Isaac. And Eliezer says, I swear it will be done. Okay. That's where we're going to lead off. And then we go. So the servant's name is Eliezer. Then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and set out, taking with him all the bounty of his master. And he made his way to Aram Naharaim, to the city of Nahor. He made the camels kneel down by the well outside the city at evening time, the time when women come out to draw water. And he said, O Lord, God of Master Abraham, grant me good fortune this day and deal graciously with my master Abraham. Here I stand by the spring as the daughters of the townsmen come out to draw water. Let the maiden to whom I say, please lower your jar that I may drink, and who replies, drink, and I will also water your camels. Let her be the one who you have decreed for your servant Isaac. Thereby shall I know that you have dealt graciously with my master. He had scarcely finished speaking when Rebekah, who was born to Betuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, parentheses, their mishpocha, their family, came out with her jar on her shoulder. The maiden was very beautiful, a virgin whom no man had known. She went down to the spring, filled her jar, and came up. The servant ran toward her and said, please let me sip a little water from your jar. Drink, my lord, she said, and she quickly lowered her jar upon her hand and let him drink. When she had let him drink his fill, she said, I will also draw for your camels until they finish drinking. Quickly emptying her jar into the trough, she went back to to the well to draw, and she drew for all his camels. The man, meanwhile, stood gazing at her, silently wondering whether the Lord had made his errand successful or not. When the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold nose ring weighing half a shekel and two gold bands from her arm, 10 shekels in weight. "Pray tell me," he said, "whose daughter are you? Is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night?" Parenthesis, there is no point in this story at which it's mentioned that Eliezer brought other guys, and there are no other guys ever mentioned in the story. So who the heck is us? I don't know, and I looked in 10 commentaries, and they didn't know either. There's a Hasidic commentary that makes a riff off of this, but none of them actually try and solve the problem. So if you're wondering, where did the us come from? The answer is, yeah, I don't know. Okay, and we're back to verse 24. She replied, "I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor." And she went on, "There is plenty of straw and feed at home, and also room to spend the night." The man bowed low in homage to the Lord and said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not withheld his steadfast faithfulness from my master. For I have been guided on my errand by the Lord to the house of my master's kinsman." The maid ran and told all this to her mother's household. Now Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban. We all know Laban. We'll learn more about Laban later. Laban ran out of the house to the spring. When he saw the nose ring and the bands on his sister's arm, and he went to hear his sister Rebekah say, "Thus the man spoke to me," he went up to the man, who was still standing beside the camels at the spring. "Come in, O blessed of the Lord," he said. "Why do you remain outside when I have made ready the house and the place for the camels?" So the man entered the house. Note, the other guys just mysteriously disappeared. And the camels were unloaded. The camels were given straw and feed, and the water was brought to bathe his feet and the feet of the men with him. But when food was set before him, he said, "I will not eat until I have told my tale," he said. "Speak then." "I am Abraham's servant," he began. "The Lord has greatly blessed my master, and he has become rich. He has given him sheep, cattle, silver and gold, male and female slaves, camels and asses. And Sarah, my master's wife, bore my master a son in her old age, and he has assigned to him everything he owns. Now my master made me swear, saying, 'You shall not get a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites in whose land I dwell, but you shall go to your father's house to my kindred and get a wife for my son.'" Okay, so the last line we're going to do, we'll do two more lines and then we'll call it. "And I said to my master, 'What if the woman does not follow me?' He replied to me, 'The Lord whose ways I have followed will send God's angel with you and make your errand successful, and you will get a wife for my son from my kindred, from my father's house.'" So I give you the long read for a lot of reasons. One is it's weird. Two is let's like just deal with the fact that a dude has sent another dude to go get a woman for his son, and the woman doesn't seem to have a lot of say in it. Although if you keep reading the text, you'll see that Laban says to Sarah at the end, to Rebekah at the end of this, Eliezer says, "We have to go now." And Laban says, "It's not our way. Stay 10 days. And Eliezer says, "No, we really got to go now." And Laban asks Rebekah, "Is it okay if we leave now?" And Rebekah says, "Yes." And that's the one like feminist moment in the whole Torah, which is Laban asks Rebekah her opinion. Not her opinion as to whether she wants to get married or not, just her opinion about whether she wants to stay 10 days or leave now. So it's very interesting. Art asked the question about the royal we. Yes, that's a nice idea. And it could be, but we never in Torah generally just kind of let a plural go away when the rest of the verse will use the singular. But it's a good question. All right, so that's kind of the general run of our text. Joe, did you want to say something?
As usual, yes, Torah is male dominated, but we have an interesting situation here. It may be a story that mostly deals with men, but we have this young woman who's not betrothed, not married. She's living with a father. I mean, it's called her father, not her parents, but her father. But she's making an awful lot of decisions here with such a young woman. She has invited either a single guy with his camels or a bunch of guys into his father's house. It doesn't even hesitate. Now, either that's a construct for the story, or the Torah normally paints a very limited picture of what women really had the right to do.
Right. I think I appreciate it, and I'm with you that, like, in order to feminize a text, we need to read a little bit into it. But we also should hold separately the point of, like, this is a whole bunch of men making decisions for a woman. Phil, go ahead, then Marilyn. And Rana has a giant statue in the frame, and I'm going to ask about it. But Phil, go ahead first.
All I was going to say is, in this time that we're talking about, do we know of any societies where women were going and choosing who they're going to marry and spend their life with? I mean, to me, this just seems like, you were saying before, when you sometimes have to just contextualize things with the times. I mean, to me, when I read this portion, it doesn't even strike me as really strange that Abraham is sending his servant off to go get this. It's because it's the story I've heard before.
Right.
And it's just, you know, olden days when they did weird stuff, like send people to go get wives. So that's how I see it.
I'm with you. I think that's a legit way to read it. But I also want to be able to say, like, if we didn't stop to think about it, we could say, like, this is okay. Like, and this is still okay. And there are people in Jewish society who think this is still okay. All right, go ahead, Marilyn, and then Rhonda, you're gonna explain this vase.
Yeah, I think that I agree. I absolutely agree with Phil, but I would take it one step farther. I've said this before. I think it's very difficult to look back at historical literature and judge it only from our own perspective. We first need to make sure we understand the historical context as we look at it. And I think that it doesn't bother me at all the way some of the other things in the Torah do, precisely because it leaves out a lot of things that so bother me in other stories in the Torah. The other thing is, this isn't Eliezer writing this. This is people living long after him writing this. It's problematic. As to the complication about the numbers, it's very difficult for me to imagine in that time that anybody would travel across an ostensibly, it's very clear that he doesn't want you to find a bride in Canaan. You got to go somewhere else, go among my family. You don't travel alone. You just don't travel alone in those days. It's very, very, very dangerous.
Right.
And I think that there was, there are always these little moments in the Torah where you're reminded that women exist. And considering the time in which the Torah was written down, it is miraculous. But if you go back into some ancient civilizations, just to answer Phil, and I'm having my brain stutter so I can't tell him, there were a couple that were women-centered, matriarchal. And so we have to recognize that from that way back in time, which is one of the ways you can say it. That's how you know somebody else was writing the Torah down, because it leaves out some of this other stuff. But
great.
Yeah, I just thought those things.
We're going to go Tanya, and then we're going to go Art, and hopefully maybe Art's microphone will work. Go ahead, Tanya.
Okay, I'm sorry, I had to unmute. You know, this may be a little off, but you know, Rivka had a lot more in common with Abraham than I've ever thought of before, because when I read this year, I thought about, you know, Rivka had her own Lech Lecha. Her own moment where she had to get thee out and go to an unknown place, because she had probably never left this area. She had probably never left this family. And here she was going to go to be with strangers. And again, you know, in the previous parasha of Vayera, we saw Abraham at the tent entertaining strangers. You know, he went and made all the food. And then Rivka, she is treating a stranger. And one of the commentaries I read say, well, you need to really watch how your future spouse treats strangers. And so here she is hauling all this water. So she is very hospitable to the stranger. And I just really thought, I never thought Rivka maybe had more in common with her father-in-law than Isaac, her own, you know, his own son did.
Well said. I want to bring up that, like, we're talking about what's called a biblical motif, right? Like a recurring theme that appears throughout the text. So the one that you mention is the theme of Abraham welcoming and being hospitable to travelers. And so we see that again here with Rivka. So Abraham tells Eliezer to find a woman who has the same qualities that he has of being hospitable to travelers. There's another motif that's being a recurring biblical motif that we see here. We're doing something very not normal for this class, which we haven't done any Hasidus, and we've been talking for 45 minutes and I haven't brought a Hasidic text yet. So bad on me. The other biblical motif that we are seeing is the women at the well stories. There are multiple stories in the Torah that deal with women at the well. The big other famous one of a righteous woman discovered at a well by a man who they then get betrothed to is the story of Moses.
Rachel.
You said Rachel, but I was going to give Moses.
Zipporah.
Right. So Zipporah is at the well. And there's some bad guys there. Okay, Art, let's try your microphone again. See if we can hear you. Nope. Nobody can hear him, right? Okay. Sorry, Art. All right, we're gonna keep going with the text. You can type it, Art. So we're gonna keep going with the text. We're gonna go into the Talmud. All those are really important points. I just thought it was really valuable to kind of look at this whole story. Rana says, if you guys haven't seen the chat, that her name is Rivka, and that this is a piece of artwork depicting Rivka holding a vessel of water on her shoulder. It's great. I love biblically related art type stuff, handicrafts. With that, let's get back to text. Oh, Phil has one more thing to say. Go ahead, Phil.
I'll make it quick, but just if we're talking feminist themes or feminist readings, I'm sorry. One thing that strikes me when I'm reading this Parsha in a negative way is I really don't like how much they focus on her attractiveness. Anyway, move on.
I think that's an obvious one. I skimmed over that idea because we were in the middle of actually reading the text, but that and the fact that they are pointing out that she's a virgin that no man had ever known is like, gluh. And like, yeah, sure, of course, 3,000 years ago, we can read this, you know, and be forgiving and understanding that this was the way that an ancient society looked at folks. I'm just going to add this other thing that you probably don't know, most of you, which is why I'm forcing us to read this text. Both Sarah and Rebecca are described by the medieval commentaries based on lines in the Talmud by their age as exceedingly young. I believe in Rebecca's case, she's 3 years old, according to the rabbinic text. So we're talking about marriage of in the rabbinic mindset, a three-year-old woman or a three-year-old girl. Why the medieval rabbis decided, or why the Midrash picks up on that, is a longer conversation. It's about, you know, kind of notions of purity and notions of sanctity and notions of perfectness. I think it's garbage and I throw it all out. And that's part of my kind of understanding that, like, some things from the ancient world should be brought forward and modernized, and some should be left behind and ignored completely. But I said it anyway so that you all knew where my biases lie, that when I read something that's not relevant, I'm going to read it out. All right, we're going to take a look at some texts that I really, really liked. This one's really weird. You're going to have to, it's going to require a radical unrereading that I love, but it's very personally relevant. So there's this line that's in the middle where Rebecca says, or Laban says, "Who are you, dude?" And Eliezer replies, "Eved Avraham Anochi," okay? "I am Abraham's servant," which is a totally innocuous line, except that there's a word there that, for those of us who are in the know, is a pretty weird one, and it's the word Anochi. So there is a word in Hebrew for I, and the word is ani. And occasionally, very rarely in the Torah, they don't use that word. They use a different word. And the word that they choose to use instead is anochi. There's one big spot in all of Torah where anochi appears, and we're going to see that in a second. So we get this cool story to lead it in. 3 days before he left the world, literally the word here is histakluto, histalkuto, which translates as self-withdrawal. So 3 days before he left the world, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch of Rimonov, who died in 1846, lay on his deathbed. That's another word that I had to look up. The Hebrew there is aras davi. And I had to reach out to my rabbi friends and be like, what the hell is this? I've never seen this word before. Aras davi appears in Psalms. I think it's Psalm 42. And it translates by the great, you know, commentators as deathbed. So a new word that I never knew. An aras davi is your deathbed. So he was lying on his deathbed knowing his end was at a near. He sighed and said, the servant of Abraham said, Anochi. His service to Abraham was such that he recognized, this is all in caps for a reason. I'm not our president who does not seem to understand how capital words work. The one that was revealed at Sinai and opened with Anochi. And I, already into my old age, I am already into my old age, and yet I still know only God, only as Hashem. Woe is me. Or literally what he says in Hebrew is, oi li, oi, right? So fascinating. So for those of you who are like, what in the heck is going on? I'll explain. So the literal meaning of the text is really simple, right? Eliezer just says, I am a servant of Abraham. That's it. That's the whole line. But the weirdness of the verse is that the word for I is Anochi. And the question then becomes, why use Anochi? So Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch of Rimonov is saying that he's rereading the text completely differently. And it's, the servant of Abraham said Anochi, which reimagines this entire story with no context in sort of this mystical, bizarre kind of alternate dimension. And the alternate dimension that we're reimagining the story is Eliezer, Abraham's servant, turned to God and addressed God by a formal name of Anochi. Why is that significant? Because the other place in Torah where the word Anochi is used, as you see at the bottom of the page in the footnotes, is the first of the Ten Commandments, where God says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Asher Hotzeiticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim Mi'Beit Avadim, right? I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. So what Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch of Rimonov is doing here is he's reading this text and saying, oh my God, Eliezer is so holy, so sainted, so amazing, so on a higher madrega, so on a higher level, that Eliezer addressed God by God's mystical formal name that would not yet be revealed for several hundred more years at Sinai. Meaning, Eliezer was so devout and so spiritual that Eliezer was aware of what would transpire at Sinai. Eliezer was aware of the revelation of Torah. Eliezer was close to God on a level that is far above all of us because he referred to God as Anochi, right? The rest of us, and he even, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch of Rimonov, one of the great rabbis of all time, says, I only know Hashem. I call God Hashem. I never call God Anochi. But Eliezer, this non-Jewish servant, he called God Anochi. Amazing. And he kind of, and the last piece to this that I'm explaining is, this is on his deathbed, right? On his deathbed, he's basically saying, I spent my whole life studying Torah. I've been spiritual and religious and prayerful, and I have not reached that level, right? Talking about end-of-life regret, like there are legitimate end-of-life regrets. Maybe I watched too much TV, right? And illegitimate ones. Maybe I didn't make enough money, right? But for this guy, his end-of-life regret is, despite a lifetime of prayer and study, is that he did not know God sufficiently. And I think that that's amazing. And I think that, that'll carry me through the whole week, which is the point being, we human beings aspire to know God. We Jews aspire to know God. And it's a process. And yet we never get there, right? We all want to know God better, but there are mystical names of God that will not fully be revealed to us in our lifetimes. And even the highest of the high rabbis don't get to the destination that they're headed to. I love that text. Some of you are like, I don't know what the rabbi just did. It all was gobbledygook to me, but whatever. I love it. I don't care. Okay, we're moving on. We'll do the next text. This is the one that generated our question at the beginning about bias and regret. this is our, I think, more self-reflective text for the day. And it's really interesting. It's really strange and does take a little bit of unpacking. It also was the reason why I really read the entire text to us at the beginning, because without context, this line is really hard to understand. So the verse goes like this. And I said to my master, what if the woman does not follow me? So this is a strange moment in Torah. This is verse 39. This is how we're basically where we finished. Eliezer is saying out loud an internal thought. This is very rare. Typically in Torah, we do not know a character's motivation for their behavior. There are very few moments. God at Sodom and Gomorrah says, shall I reveal this thing that I am about to do to Abraham, knowing that Abraham will not like it, right? There are a few other moments in Torah where we get the internal motivation of a character, but not many. And this is one of them, right? He says, you know, I go there and like, what if, and I find the woman. What if I find the woman and I offer her the stuff and she won't come with, right? So we're kind of like wondering, like, why is he afraid? Like, why is he expressing fear that the mission will fail? So there's a nice commentary on this. But before we get to the nice commentary, we have to understand Rashi's take on this. So if you look at the Hebrew, it says, Vayomer el Adoni, ulai lo telech ha'isha acharai, right? And I said to my master, ulai, which is Hebrew for perhaps, it won't come, the woman won't come with me. Here's the problem. The word ulai in Hebrew has a vav in it, and this one is missing a vav. So it could be read one of two ways. It could be read as ulai, perhaps, or it could be read as eli lo telech ha'isha acharai. With me, the woman will not come. And that there's no doubt, there's no perhaps. So Rashi pulls that apart. Rashi, our French commentator, who's always our main guy. And he says, peradventure, which is just a fancy word for perhaps. But also, with me, the woman will not follow me. Rashi continues, the word ulai, perhaps, is written without a vav, so that it may be read a lie unto me. And now we get a midrash. This is how Rashi rolls. He'll just, you know, he'll see a problem and he'll answer it with a homiletical story that the rabbis invented to explain the whole thing. And the funny thing about that is Rashi is often held up in rabbinic tradition as the guy who explains it simply. Sometimes his quote-unquote simple explanation requires bringing in another story from somewhere else, which is pretty wild. And it's not the simple explanation, but is a what's called midrashic explanation, trying to explain the entire story of the Wizard of Oz by parenthetically bringing in the plot line of the Broadway musical Wicked, right? That you don't need to understand the musical Wicked in order to see the Wizard of Oz. By the way, I've always wanted to figure out if there was a way to do this with The Wiz and Wizard of Oz, but unfortunately The Wiz is basically just a retelling with Michael Jackson and Diana Ross. And it also has that really scary scene in the subway with the trash cans, which terrified me as a child, and I still don't like that movie. I like Michael, don't like the trash cans. Okay, moving on. The verse says, or Rashi says, Eliezer had a daughter. This is our midrash, right, to explain. Rashi continues with this midrash. Eliezer had a daughter, and he was endeavoring to find some reason why Abraham should say that he must appeal to him, Eliezer, that he should give his daughter in marriage to Isaac. Okay? So let me explain that. Eliezer is told by Abraham, go get me a wife for my son. Eliezer goes, all right, I'll do it. Eliezer meets the woman. He's like, all right, I'll bring her back. And then he starts to say to Laban, all right, I want to bring her back. And then he turns to Betuel, the father, and says, I want to bring her back. Suddenly he has a thought in his head. He goes, wait a second. What if she won't come back? And parenthetically, Rashi and the Midrash throw into there this whole other external motivation that has just occurred to Eliezer. And the external motivation is that Eliezer suddenly realizes, wait a second, I have a daughter. And if I fail at bringing Rivka back for Isaac, then Abraham will have no choice but to marry his son off to my daughter. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. Which is fascinating, because Eliezer has apparently just realized that he has an internal bias. Here's our whole question, the start of the class, an internal bias against fulfilling his task, right? He has a whole job to do, but it actually is counter to what would be in his own best interest, which is fascinating, right? Suddenly he's like, maybe I want to screw this up intentionally and not bring back Rebecca because it would maybe work out better for me. So that's the whole setup for this commentary of us, according to the Hasidic interpretation, trying to check ourselves about our own internal biases and our own personal motivations for things and our ability to reflect on a thing that happened. So we get this. Why does the text mention Eliezer, perhaps going back on his word, only at the moment that Rebecca at the house of Betuel, and not immediately at the moment Abraham asked him? So we get that midrash, right? The midrash that says, you know, Eliezer suddenly realizes, like, maybe I don't really want to bring back Rebecca. But the question that our commentator immediately throws in there is, wait a second, why would he feel it now? Why not, like, a week ago when Abraham asked him? You know, maybe he should have thought back then, I'm going to be biased in the moment. I'm not going to want to fulfill my task. So here's the rest of it. According to Menachem Mendel of Kotsk, one of our friends, the text is teaching us that in all the other ways that Eliezer was influenced and biased on the matter, he was unable to perceive his bias. And only when he stood in Bethuel's house, all his bias and inclination was released. And only then was it fitting for him to judge himself and to discern that he was biased at that moment personally. This is the kicker that's really beautiful. Thus it is with human nature. At the moment that something happens, one does not perceive their own bias to it. But rather, after time passes, one knows that, at the time, they had personal bias, right? Maybe this was a really long walk for the rabbis to say the thing that we all know, which is that hindsight is 20/20. But it's a really lovely long walk, right? To explain this whole midrash of Eliezer, who's sent on a task by Abraham, and that Eliezer is not aware while he is on the way with the camels to the well that he's not really fully in it, right? His heart is not 100% there. He actually kind of maybe doesn't want to succeed. But he gets to Betuel's house, and he suddenly has a moment. And the whole read, by the way, this whole thing happened because there's a missing vav in a four-letter Hebrew word, right? And so they create this really wild scenario where Eliezer looks up and goes, huh, maybe I don't really want this to succeed. Maybe this isn't in my best interest, right? Which is just this beautiful, lovely idea. And then it gives us all an opportunity to say, like, what are my motivations? Is my heart really in this? If my heart is not really in something, why isn't my heart really not in it? And should I be upfront about that at the beginning? Or should I be able to reflect on that and tell the person, like, yo, I can't carry this out? I'll give you my quick story about this relatedly, which is interesting. I don't know if it's either here nor there, but a number of years ago, when I was working at the Jewish day school in Denver, Colorado, the girls' volleyball team made the playoffs, and they rescheduled the first round game for the school so that it did not fall on Shabbat, because normally they played these games on Saturday, right? It would have been a Saturday day game, and our kids would have had to forfeit. Now, this was a problem the day school had dealt with for years, which is that the Colorado High School Athletic Administration never seemed to care about scheduling all of our games in the playoffs, and we would ask the school district's athletic division to politely reschedule, and they would say, no, you played in this league, and the rules of the league are you'll play when we tell you to. And the school, for a decade, actually had to forfeit a whole bunch of playoff games and a whole bunch of sports because the school didn't do it. And finally, at some point, there was like an appeal made by a parent, and it literally went to like the Colorado Court of Appeals, and like it became a national story that the basketball team had made the playoffs and that that CHASA, the Colorado High School Athletic Administration, was just going to tell him, like, nah, sorry, you have to forfeit. So finally, this all got rectified, and they nicely and politely moved the game to another day. So the team won that game, which is great, and then they scheduled the next game for Tuesday. And the Tuesday game fell on Purim. And so the admin team had to get together and be like, what are we going to do? The girls have a volleyball game on Purim. Is this okay? And the admin went around the table, and everybody said, isn't there a way we can play this game? And they looked at me as a rabbi, and I was like, I really think it's a bad idea to play this game. We should just forfeit or ask the league to move it. And they all looked at me like, the league is not going to move it. Like, the league already, we went through 10 years of hell to get the league to move our games to Saturday night instead of Saturday day. No way we're just going to pop off with another random Jewish holiday and let us move it. And I was like, well, you know, all right. My opinion was that we should forfeit. And they said, all right, we're not going to forfeit. We're going to play the game, and you, Rabbi Goodman, are going to find some way of you know, doing Purim for the girls' volleyball team. So what I wound up doing was reading the Megillah to the volleyball team after they lost the second set, which was weird, and it's what we did. Before I left the meeting, after they decided what to do, the head of school, like, shut the door and looked at me, and he said, I know you didn't want to do this. Are you gonna be okay doing this? And I said, yeah, you know, I'll go ahead and I'll carry out your wishes, you know, regardless of the fact that I didn't vote for it. So just being able to kind of stand in the moment and say, is my heart really in this? And to reflect was really valuable, to be able to say, I didn't agree with this, but I will go and read Megillah for these kids because it's the right thing to do. All right, with that, we'll take a pause and let anybody throw in any opinions that or thoughts that they've had on the text up till here. If nobody does, there's one more text coming. It's really my favorite, and it's really lovely and simple and quick. Any thoughts on this whole weird, wild ride of, you know, your internal motivations? I think that either means that everybody is blown away by it and it's amazing, or that all of you were like, I don't know what the hell's going on, and Rabbi, just keep going. Okay, the next one's Rich has a thing. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, I was actually going back to where we discussed the appropriateness of the Torah into that perspective, whether it's how women are treated or whatever the story is, and some of the issues that Joe mentioned about violence and people's perspective. Is that a problem, the fact that the Torah is written in its day, if you will, in that someone who wants to be, is thinking of becoming a Jewish person, is that a complete turnoff to people? I guess it depends upon the person, but is that a problem with our ability to retain membership, for example, and participation in Jewish life?
The conversation I have online with folks that's the most frustrating, that I get so tired of, is, or the fight that I have to have, is there's a Christian understanding of Jews that we have a quote unquote Old Testament God of wrath, that the literal text in Deuteronomy is the God that we believe in, that it's all freaking lightning bolts from heaven. And I went to rabbinical school, and we spent like 0 minutes. I'm not kidding. Like 0 minutes on reading the Torah without commentary, right? We don't read the Torah without commentary. We don't read it without trying to read it through another lens. Even I explained to you that Rashi, who is believed to be the foremost commentator, for Orthodox Jews, he is the literal understanding of the Torah. He just read a whole verse of Torah through the lens of a story that's in the Midrash that has nothing to do with what literally happens in the Torah. This whole problem of Ulai or Eli, right? Rashi literally unreads the Torah in a way that completely inserts information into it that was not there. So for me, if a person is turned off by the literal of the Torah, my answer to them is either, yeah, me too, or you're reading it wrong, right? Those are my only two answers for a person. A person who reads it as an ancient text from 3,000 years ago that's in favor of poking out eyes and paying the bribe price for a woman who you've sexually assaulted is not my Torah. It's not. It's just I find it irrelevant and pointless, right? If I was supposed to read the Torah literally in its time period and just import it into the modern day, I would quit the religion. I would never have been a Jew in the – I would have turned in my Jew card, even with the kugel and the whitefish salad that comes with it, right? But that's not Judaism. That's ancient Israelite pagan practice, you know, with a fancy book put onto it. It's not Judaism, right? Judaism is rabbinic Judaism. Judaism is modern Judaism. Judaism is Hasidic Judaism. You know, you lay all this stuff on top of it. It doesn't exist in a vacuum. Joe, then Phil.
Yeah, so in my younger days, when I was just a little bit less naive than I am now, I suggested that since each of us are inspired by God, according to tradition, that we use our inspiration to change some of the text. For example, Torah text, to update it and modernize it so that we don't have to interpret the words according to modern thought. But this was soundly shot down as blasphemy. And it seems to me I have a problem, although I understand the need for tradition and the desire for tradition. It has given for thousands of years enemies of the Jews an opening that I think is unnecessary. And I don't know what the right answer is, but I just wanted to mention this.
No, you're it's well said. I think, you know, it's my I complain about like people online not understanding how we read the text, but it's not really a complaint. It's my job, Joe. It's my job to explain how Judaism views the world. And, you know, the fact that we are 2% of the American population and 0.5% of the world, and people are constantly like, rrr, 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 I don't understand this Old Testament God of yours. And I'll be like, well, you know, if you want to stick around for a while, I'll explain it to you. Because 98% of the country doesn't understand.
I'm 100% sure that if we started rewriting Torah and Talmud to modern standards, there would be more work for rabbis for an indefinitely long period of time, far beyond the time when any of us would still be alive. You would not have to worry about job security.
Listen, I need the work, man. I need the work. All right, Phil and Marilyn, go ahead.
Well, number one, I've always liked the fact that Judaism is not missionary religion. You know, that we're not out there looking for people to join, but, you know, if you want to talk, we'll talk. What I was going to say is, did I forget my point? I may have lost it. Go to Maryland. I'll get it again. Go to Maryland. I'll get
Feel free to write it in the chat so you don't forget it, and then we'll come back to you. Go ahead, Maryland.
I just want to point out that while I understand exactly what Joe is saying, while we haven't actually rewritten the Torah, we have rewritten Judaism, and we've done it regularly over time. And I grew up. And by the way, happy birthday, Joe. And I grew up at a time when, you know, women weren't necessarily bar mitzvah, or if we were, we couldn't read Torah. You know, it had to be on Friday night. And my granddaughters my kids were both b'nai mitzvot. Both in Boston and here, an egalitarian show where I can read Torah if I want. I used to do it all the time. Don't do it anymore. Long story. But anyway, so I think that to a certain degree, we have rewritten Judaism while leaving the history so that, because it's nice to know where you come from and how we've evolved as human beings and as a religion. And yes, I know there are still Jews who take the Torah literally, but that is not the majority of us, particularly not outside the ultra-Orthodox communities. And so I think that we're going to continue to change, too. And it's nice to know where you came from. And it's nice to know that you can continue to evolve as a species, as human beings.
All right, Phil, did you figure it out yet?
Yeah. I have an easier time reconciling with my religion having ancient texts and ancient practices that are questionable than I would being part of the religion where there are more people than us in the world. Because I'm not saying this to disparage anybody, but if I was in those religions, I feel like I would have many more things to reconcile with from much more recent history. You know what I mean? Like, if I was a Catholic, I would have a lot more recent things. Like, Jewish people haven't really been responsible for bad things unless you're an anti-Semite. But, like, it's historically speaking, you can't in real life pin that many things on us in a negative way, I don't think.
Right. So you make an interesting point, which I won't belabor, but the interesting thing is for rabbis and for Jews to have to reconcile texts that are problematic is far easier and far better than reconciling behaviors that are problematic, power structures that are problematic, histories that are problematic. But I think, you know, I think faith believers, to be felicitous to all religions, faith believers do the work, right? We work to reconcile those things, which is why I started this class off by talking about why this text isn't sufficiently feminist for my tastes. And I tried, and I will continue to try to, you know, reconcile it as best I can. All right, go ahead, Tanya. Still waiting. Oh, there you go.
This is back to your comment about the God of the Old Testament being the lightning bolt God. This may not be a good answer, but you know what my answer is? I go back to the 13 attributes. And, you know, I kind of direct people in that direction. And I tell them, just like people, God has emotions. And he gets angry. You know, he's jealous. But sometimes we don't understand those words because, you know, when you translate things to English, they do lose their shades of meaning. And sometimes, you know, that's an answer because I've had people say that to me before. And again, I don't have all the answers to everything, but I do like to redirect them in that direction. And I do like to tell them that one of the ways that we are made in the image of God is that we have emotions and God has emotions.
Nice.
I'm sorry.
No, that's good. That's really well said. The other thing that Tanya threw up in the chat was the problem about, you know, how could a 3-year-old water the camels? Never worry about facts and science when it comes to the rabbis and their stories. They just do it a certain way. They just throw stuff in there, and whether it's supposed to be literally true or figuratively true is another question. All right, we're going to do the last text, then we're going to call it a day. I'm already happy that Jeremy didn't kick me off at 1:30, which happens occasionally. These are my favorite texts. I probably should have brought them at the beginning. They're not particularly solving any of the problems that we discussed, and they're really mostly relevant for those of us who like praying because they're really lovely texts on prayer. So the back end of the story is, and we skipped this part because I didn't want to read 20 verses to get there. The back end of the story is Eliezer succeeds, Rebecca comes with him, and we get this really lovely scene, which actually happens again later in the Torah with one of our other patriarchs, of the moment at which Isaac and Rebecca meet. And the moment is this, verse 63. And Isaac went out walking in the field toward evening, and looking up, he saw camels approaching, right? So, of course, they'll eventually meet cute in this arranged marriage, and then they get married 2 verses later. By verse 66, they're done, okay, and the marriage has happened. But there's this moment, right? And we get this thing in Torah, which is that specific details are being brought to bear, and they don't seem to be necessary. And so the rabbis of the Talmud and afterward are fascinated, like, why add these specific details? So the specific details that are interesting here are he went out in the field toward evening. Okay, so all of that is interesting. Why are those the details of which at the marriage, the meeting takes place? But there's another detail, which is a Hebrew word that's a problem. So the Hebrew is Vayetze Yitzhak Lesuach Besadeh. So to take a walk in a field would be Lehalech. Lesuach, if you look in all of the Hebrew grammar books and all of your, if you pulled a Tanakh off your, or a Torah off your shelf, you would not find the same translation for the word lasuach twice, because this word barely ever appears in Torah. It shows up in Psalms, as we'll see in a second. Today, when we use the word in Hebrew, siach, a sicha in Hebrew is a conversation. So a literal translation of this would be, and Isaac went out a-talking in the field, which makes no sense, right? It's very strange. So our commentators are going to have fun here, and two of our favorite commentators are going to be riffing off of a line in the Talmud. So Isaac went out walking, lasuach, in the field. So the first commentator is Rabbi Nachman of Braslov. Sicha, talking, always means tefillah, praying. As it's said, a prayer of the lowly man when he is faint and pours forth his plea, siach, before the Lord. So that's the opening of Psalm 102. The prayer of Isaac was with all the utterances, the siach, of the field. All the flowers of the earth burst forth with their strength amidst his prayer. So this is Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, who is the Breslov Hasidim are, they're a school unto themselves. He was wild. People talked about him having kind of like brilliance, but also kind of manic depressive psychosis capabilities, that he was very, he had very strange behaviors, but he was also, you know, unparalleledly amazing. And he has this move here where he basically reads Isaac's behavior is in this incredibly spiritual light, to say the reason that the word siach is used here is that he's praying. And the reason that he's siach besadeh, that he's praying in a field, is that he's gathering the collective energy of that field for his tefillah, right? For those of us who like nature and who feel spiritual in nature, this is your jam. This is the whole ball of wax, right? There's this lovely, lovely thing where basically he goes into a field and one of two things is happening. Either Isaac goes into a field and he sees the birds chirping and the trees flowering and the flowers blooming and he's just blown away. And this is prayer in and of itself for him. And the life force of the Holy One, Blessed Be God, is present for him and he's amped up about it, right? The prayer is the nature. Or there's another way of looking at it, which is sort of cool also, which is to say that Isaac, our patriarch, was of such a deep spiritual nature that he's like Snow White in the movie Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. When Snow White's wandering around and singing, little birds land on her shoulder and little chipmunks chitter up to her. And the woods come alive when Snow White is walking through them because she's so wonderful. Isaac was the same way, right? Yitzchak goes into the sadeh and he is siach the sadeh. He is dialoguing, and the squirrels and the chipmunks and the birds and the flowers and the trees become alive because Isaac is praying, right? And I think both are lovely. The idea that we find ourselves more spiritual in nature and nature comes alive for us when we are praying in it means on a whatever level that you want to take this text, that some kind of divine life energy occurs when we connect with the outdoors and we connect the outdoors with God. That's the best thing I could say in this whole class. And of course, it comes in the 54th minute. Okay, final text, which is basically kind of a similar idea, but a little bit different, from our friend Simcha Bunim of Pshischa. He says, and it's the same verse and it's the same line from Talmud. It was taught, Isaac affixed the afternoon prayer, as it says, and Isaac went out walking in the field toward evening. Sicha, talking, always means tefillah, praying. So that's the full verse from the Talmud in Brachot 26. So just to explain that first line, this thing about Isaac affixing the afternoon prayer, there's a lovely idea in the Talmud that our three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, were the three individuals who set the Shacharit, the Mincha, and the Ma'ariv prayer, right? Jews pray three times a day. And so the reason Jews pray three times a day is there is a verse in the Torah from Abraham about Abraham getting up in the morning, Vayashkem Avraham Baboker, and that means, according to our rabbis of the Talmud, he was getting up to put on his tefillin and his tallit and pray. Never mind that prayer hasn't been ordained yet to any of these three patriarchs and would not be until God appears at Sinai. Doesn't matter. For the rabbis, they say the morning prayer goes to Abraham, the evening prayer goes to Jacob, because there's a thing about Jacob in the evening. And of course, here we have towards evening, meaning before evening, we have the afternoon, and that's where we get this idea. Okay, final words from Simcha Bunim. Moreover, every conversation Isaac had was within the realm of tefillah, prayer. So Simcha Bunim sees the move, sees that the word sicha, conversation, is being related to tefillah, prayer. And Simcha Bunim goes one step further. He says, yo, you may say that he instituted the afternoon prayer because we see he was being siach lifnei erev, that he was having a conversation in the fields before the evening, and that means prayer. But we could read it a different way. We could read it as every moment that Isaac was siaching, every moment that he was talking, he was praying, right? This is a spin on Abraham Joshua Heschel's line when he went marching at Selma, I was praying with my feet. This is a riff on that, which is that Isaac was praying with his mouth. But every moment that Isaac opens his mouth, he is betfilah, he is in prayer. And it's not an idea that we've never seen before. It's an idea we've seen before in other places. The idea being, what would it be like if every conversation we had with our fellow human being, we considered tefillah before Hashem Yisborach, prayer before the God, our God, right? Understanding that our words are powerful, that our words are holy and are sacred, and that they carry real meaning, intention, and power. What would it be like if we were more like Isaac, that we understood that our words were really important and really powerful and meaningful, and that everything that we said could be prayer? All right. That's our class for the day. I hope you guys are good. If you want to stick around and hang out and swap recipes,